1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 4, 3, 2, 1. How's that?
Well, Sandy, I'll clue you in first in our history of my family and how they came to the United States.
I'll give your name first.
My name is Robert Campbell Reeve, and I live in Anchorage, Alaska. I've been here, this is my 39th year since I first came here, in my 29th year of continuous residence. I operate the Revolution Airways, a corporation which is a certificated United States air carrier and serves Far Western Alaska and the Aleutian, Shumagin, and Pribilof Islands. We have 8 multi-engine aircraft, 2 DC-4s, 2 DC-3s, 2 Curtiss C-46 cargo aircraft, and 2 Grumman amphibians, which we use to serve some of the canneries where there are presently no fields. We have a rather unenviable situation in the maintenance department, because we have 8 multi-engine aircraft with 4 different kinds of engines, props, and accessories, and so forth on there, which every airline tries to minimize to the greatest degree they can on there. About a month ago, we were worse off yet. We had 8 airplanes with 5 different kinds of engines and props and accessories and components. However, we whittled that down to 8 with 4 here just recently. My family first came to the United States in the year 1660, plus or minus a year or two. They were the original settlers of Southold at the far eastern tip of Long Island. They were French Huguenots, and they were refugees from the political oppression that was existed in northern France at that time. In fact, their name was not Reeve, their name was Rive, R-I-V-E-T, and they anglicized or Americanized their name to the present spelling of R-E-E-V-E on their arrival in Long Island. In fact, there are 1 or 2 of them still living there in Long Island and Matatuck and Southold. However, the most of them were of a pioneer nature, and as the West opened up, first Ohio, and then Wisconsin, and then Washington, and then Alaska, one by one they spread out all over North America. Even some 1 or 2 of the branches of the family were the pioneers up in Alberta, Canada, in its earliest days of settling and homesteading. There were 3 in our family, 3 boys. My mother died when I was 2, my father remarried, and I had a half-sister by this later marriage on there. My twin brother used to be one of the original officers in the old United States Air Corps. He entered the Air Corps in 24, and he was killed in a bomber crash in a B-18 in 1938. I will go on with my early boyhood. It was a typical boyhood in Wisconsin on there. My father was a depot agent, and I became early existent with the most important part of transportation in those days, which was the railroad. And however, at that time, my real future, I felt, was not in transportation. I had a modest reputation then as a champion skunk trapper of Dane County, Wisconsin, and I'd hope sometime when I was old to go up in northern Canada and continue it with more valuable fur in northern Canada. However, I still retain that reputation as a champion skunk trapper to a certain degree in Wisconsin, and I will show you a clipping from a hometown paper of Madison, Wisconsin, which shows that in headlines a year or two ago when I was expected to come back there on a trip. And so it is very very few people on there who have a diversified reputations as I have had. Well, any event, I was laying in bed last night in anticipation of your interview here, Sandy, and I was trying to think back to the first time that I ever heard of an airplane. And I think it was on the occasion when I was either 6 or 7 years old, which is about 4 years after the Wright brothers had made their first flight in 1903. And it was at a Christmas party for the first year of school, and Santa Claus came in, and he was all dressed up, and his punchline was, he says, I couldn't get the reindeer out, so I got my airplane, and I just got in my airplane here and came here. So it was quite a thrill on there. So that was approximately, I must have been about 6 years old then. In any event, I did not take too great an interest in aircraft at that time, because there were very rarely saw any wrong. Once in a while, you'd see a fun headline on there, like time Cal Rogers flew across the states, or and subsequent events on there, or Lincoln Beachy did his loops, and or how he crashed in, I think it was San Francisco Bay in the earlier years. Those were real headlines in those days, and of course, a lot of those old timers, their great ultimate end in life was not to live and become old like the Wilbur Wrights or Glenn Curtis or a few of them on there. They all died violent deaths in their old types of wooden aircraft on there. They would each one would try to outdo the other in different types of maneuvers and loops and dives and so forth, and also in the types of weather they flew in, and as I say, none of these things contributed to longevity that you have now. Of course, you don't have they didn't have the CAA, or as it is called, the FAA, the Federal Aviation Agency, in those days on there to put a clamp on some of these wild maneuvers on there. In any event, when I was 15 years old, ever since I was 6 or 7 years old, I'd planned on running away from home and getting out of there, because I always thought that there was something more to the world than the rolling hills around Wanakee, Wisconsin, where I was raised there. And so one day, in the time World War came along, I lived in a pro-German community on there, and there was their fathers and mothers had come from Germany and were still loyal to the Germans on there, and as I said. It hazard of being repetitious, there was a tremendous amount of sentiment pro-German for the Germans on there, and anti-German for the old American residents of Wanakee, of which there were very few, as opposed to the modern immigration of Irish and Germans who had originally settled that southern Wisconsin country. Well, in any event, I took off, and I managed to one thing which most people, or which most young people, expose their youth by talking too much. I had already figured that out. If I kept my mouth shut, that I would that I could give an impression of being 18, 19, or 20 years old and to get in the service. And I think due to this one thing that I was successful in enlisting on there, and then I further perpetuated my age by, I found a picture of a girl with a couple of kids on there, and I told everybody it was my wife and kids on there, and I had a certain great respect as a family man in my regiment on there.
You were 15 at the time?
I was 15 at the time. In any event, I was discharged as a sergeant in 1919. I've been ordered overseas several times, but our regiment on there had always been split up into other outfits on there. It was the old 10th United States Infantry, and had already served overseas on a number of terms. And due to the experienced soldiers in it, it had been split up into various new regiments, which were sent overseas. In any event, I was discharged as a sergeant. I was a sergeant when I was 16, and I was discharged when I was 17, and I went back, and at the request my parents on there to resume my school education, my high school education. I had had 1 year as a freshman in high school, that is the first year, and I went back and attempted to resume it, but the pace was too slow for me back there, and after a few months in school on there, I decided I was going to see the West. So I took off and got the West Coast, and California then was just in its in its first stages of settling. Very few airplanes around there then. This was in 1920. Except, well, I might go back to my experience with the airplanes on there. In the service on there, I recall the first airplane I ever actually saw was at Indianapolis, Indiana, in early 1918 on a war bond drive where a group of Jennies flew over the town where we were all making march and on parade to inspire the purchase of these war bonds. And right there, it was raining and muddy and slushy out there, and right there in that time, I believe I had my first seed planted in me that I was going to take to the air someday, because I envied them, as I say, the up in the air on there, and they weren't out in the slush and freezing their feet as we soldiers were down below. And when I was discharged at the then Camp Custer, a lot of the barnstormers had come back. The old fighter pilots had come back from France, and they had bought some old Jennies for $50-$100 a piece, and they used to come out the parade ground there. And every payday, I would go up and take several rides with them. And that was one of those days was some of the great thrills of my life. Well, any event, I came back there, and as I said, I continued on to the west on there. Well, I saw the west wasn't enough, and so I decided to go over to the Orient. So I went to the Orient, and I spent a year and a half over there, all the way from Singapore up to Shanghai, Pekin, Vladivostok, Darien, all those old ports there. Most of the time I was employed by the Chinese Maritime Customs Service as a checker on there. Of course, I had many experiences over there, as it happened to anybody in the Orient. And about 1921, a letter from my father finally ran me down in Vladivostok, and he wanted me to come back and as a favor to him and resume my education instead of being as he called it, a tramp running around the world on there. Well, I wasn't exactly a tramp. I paid my way and job to job, but I thought if he put the stigma of a tramp on me, which in those old days was quite a stigma, I would try to eradicate that in his estimation. So I started back to the States. I was on a boat. I think it was the name of the Vanita on there, an old Liberty ship of World War I. And it had been named after the town of Vanita, Oklahoma, for a wheat town, for oversubscribing their quota in World War I bonds. As I recall, that was how the Vanita got its name. In any event, we had engine trouble, and we had to land in Dutch Harbor in the Aleutians on there. And I well recall the day because it was the longest day of the year, June 21, 1921. Well, that was my first time I put feet on Alaska soil. In any event, I continued on. I went back home, and I resumed my education, and I completed 3 years of high school in 1 year, and went on to the University of Wisconsin, and into the law school there. Well, about that time, there was a couple old barnstormers around there named Cash Chamberlain and Walt Bullock, and pretty an old Northwest Airline pilot just retired, and they had a Jenny out of Madison on there. And I used to go out there, and whenever I could spare up a few dollars or get a ride and get a few minutes instruction. Well, at the end of about 2.5 years in law school on there, of course I was working my way through there, and it got too much for me. My trying to make a living on there, worked my way through in the college on there, and the professors got pretty tough on me, so I finally decided to drop out and resume my education and take up flying, which I did. I went down to First Florida. There, that was when the boom was going on, and I became associated with a barnstormer named Locklear down there. And then so I went over to Beaumont, and by a strange coincidence, on the day that Lindbergh, I think it was it 26 or 27, anyway, on the day that Lindbergh made his first anniversary of Lindbergh's flight, over to the open. That's when that was the day I sold it. From thence I went on. I sold it with a couple of old barnstormers from Texas, and they were really a couple of characters. One was named Maverick on there, Billy Maverick. He was the grandson of the old Bill Maverick, who had, from whence the name Maverick, as a cattle with an owner, had got its name on there. I don't mean to digress into cattle on this, but in order to perpetuate an old fact, I might explain that this fellow Maverick just he went over the state of Texas, which was pretty big then, and every cattle without a brand, he put his own name brand on, and thus acquired them, and hence any cattle without a brand on his name was known as a Maverick from then on. Billy, in a way, was a kind of a Maverick himself of the Maverick family, and the fellow Hazard with him, Haphazard. I shall state that those two names were quite appropriate for those two characters. In any event, I got my license and went on from there, and then I entered the Army Air Corps at Marchfield, and after that I went to work my first flying job. I went back to Wisconsin and I barnstormed around the southern Wisconsin, and then I had a chance to get a job down in Arizona, in Phoenix, at what they call the old Scenic Airways. Well, that was quite a modern flying outfit, because they had ample finances to get new aircraft, such as the Ford Tri-Motor and Fleet, the new Fleet biplane for instruction, and the Fairchild 71s. It was there that I first flew my old Fairchilds on there. We used to take many flights down to the Gulf of Mexico there, and with fishing parties and prospecting parties and so forth on there. And there were really no fields on there. We used to land all over Arizona on the beach, and on the beaches or flat spot. So it was really in there where I really got my wits first sharpened up on non-landing fields. About that time, in late 28, that all the airlines were being drawn together and into regular airlines with routes across the United States on there. They were TWA and Western Air Express and Halliburton Airlines and Fly Airlines and a lot of others on there. And I realized at that time that the scope of my job in Phoenix was very limited on there. So I went back to the Ford factory, who were building a number of these Ford Tri-Motor airplanes and selling them to the airlines, with the idea of being checked out on them and getting a job on one of the, well, either in South America with Pan American or in one of the airlines that were making transcontinental routes across the states. I went back to Ford factory and completed my assignment on there in 3 months, where you were taught all the mechanics of the airplane and the construction and everything, and certain maintenance on there, which was quite easy for me to go through, as I already had a mechanics license. They're known as engine and aircraft license in those days, and I think my number was 5291. And my commercial license was number 4795. In any event, I received an offer of a job for Pan American Airways, and I delivered one of their Fords to them, back to New York City, with a cab with an old timer from Pan American named Cap Swinton. He was one of the original pilots of Pan American. Thence I went down to Miami, where I was assigned on the run between Miami and Belize, British Honduras, thence to David, Panama, and thence down to Panama on a Sikorsky S-38 on there. I cannot offhand recall the pilot on this run who checked me out, or he was one of the real, one of the old Navy flyers of World War One who had gone with Pan American, has had a number of the others. About that time, Pan American Airways had interested a group named Pacific International Airways of Peru and the W.R. Grayson Company in forming an airline and operating a mail route between Panama just down through to Colombia, Buenaventura, Colombia, to Guayaquil, to Tolera, Peru, down to Lima, to Arica, Chile, to Antofagasta, all the way down to Santiago, and then from thence over to Mendoza in the Argentine, and on to Buenos Aires and Montevideo in Uruguay. Well, I think this was probably one of the great years of my life, because I pioneered the routes from Lima south on there whenever they were opened up, and across the Andes, and I spent 2.5 years down there. And about this time, and I think it was one of my flights over the Andes, that Reeve Airways was born, because about that time, in the fall of 29, correction, the winter of 29 and 30, when Carl Ben Eielson had been lost up in Siberia. And my father used to send me the papers from the States on there, and I was especially attracted to this, not only from the fact that I had been in Alaska and had every now and then entertained the thought of returning there to start my own airline, but from the fact that I had known Carl Ben Eielson at the University of Wisconsin at the Phi Delta Phi fraternity house there, of which he had been a member a year or two before. And even then, Carl Ben Eielson in those years of 22 or 23 was recognized as a real personality, because he was one of the few alumni who had their pictures hanging on the walls of the Phi Delta Phi house. Well, in any event, I used to read these names of Gillum and Crossan and Ed Young, Frank Dorbrandt and Noel Ween and all of them on there, and I decided that within, as soon as I had a proper stake on there, that I was going to shake the dust in the vernacular is of Santiago off my feet and go to Alaska and start my own airline. Well, that thought on my part was accentuated by the fact that I, one morning after a degree of celebrating with some friends at night on there, I wrecked a Lockheed, one of the Pan Americans new Lockheeds down in Santiago, and I know that those people were very stuffy in New York, so I beat them to the punch and resigned. I went back, as I say, I went back to the States on there, and about that time I had a stake of approximately $17,000 that I had saved up in South America, and I figured that I would double that, and so I started playing the stock market. Well, I was what they call a bull when I should have been a bear, and overnight a thing happened down there which next to the original break in 1929 contributed more to the instability of the market than anything else, and that was the fact when Great Britain went off the gold standard in February of 1932 and I was wiped out completely. In the meanwhile, I had caught polio and from falling through a marsh, and it would become very ill. And I decided that I would try and beat my way west. And the best way I could do that to keep tough on there was to be on the outdoors and just get hardened up again. And that I did. And then I got, instantly I got in Seattle about the time some of the flyers were trying to win that $100,000 prize of being the first to fly from the west coast of the United States to Japan. There had been many attempts, and I ran in at that time into Nat Brown, who had been one of the founders of a competitive airline in South America when I was down there, known as the New York Real and Buenos Aires airline, which was later absorbed by Pan American Airlines. And I assisted him and his mechanics and his plane and getting it off on there. But as everybody knows, he eventually ended in a disaster by his plane disintegrating in the air when it was hit by a refueling airplane, the hose of it on there, and fortunately survived by going through his parachute. Brown later came to Alaska and was one of the old-time flyers in Alaska, and he now lives in Seattle somewhere. In any event, I arrived in Alaska on June 3rd, 1932. Went to Seward and I looked things around there, and first thing I did, I ran into one of an old friend of mine named Matt Nieneman, who had been flying for down in Mexico, and I've been flying the mail down there for Pan American, and he'd been flying payrolls down there for some oil company. In any event, he'd also become civilized and was an employee then of what was known as the old Alaskan Airways, which had been founded by American Airlines here in about 29. And about that time, to bring up the history, early history of flying on there, there was also an organization there named Pacific International Airlines, who had been organized by a fellow named Ted Lowe from California. And about the time I got here, these two were combined and bought out by Pan American Airways and known as Pacific Alaska Airways. In any event, I came to both. To Seward, I didn't see much future in there due to the hills and trees and mounds on there, and the fact that it already had a railroad in there. And I came to Anchorage and found out there also that they had far too many pilots here, and for the economy of the town, and the best situated one was a fellow named Charlie Rutan, who had married the baker's daughter here and was eating regularly. In any event, I'd heard about a fellow named Owen Meals, one of the pioneer flyers of Alaska, who lived in Valdez, who had an old Eagle Rock, which various people who he had rented to had wrecked on several occasions. And so I decided to go to Valdez, and on arriving at Valdez, I made a deal with Owen to rebuild the airplane. And at so much an hour, I got $1 an hour, as I recall, and I was regular capitalist then because it was my only source of income. And on fixing his airplane up, I started to barnstorm over the country on there. There wasn't too much flying in Valdez at the time, and every now and then I picked up a charter flight to Nome or to say Midland Island or Fairbanks on there. But at that time, Valdez had been an old gold mining center of Alaska. However, when the World War I came on and all the young fellows and the miners had gone to the States on there, the mines had closed down, and they found easier ways to make a living than to walk up in the glaciers and work in these mines, and they never came back. However, there were many of the old timers who had these mines who would like naturally to go and get them back into production. And I began to see that if I was to go and have any success on being a second warm trip Pan American, and there, as I say, any degree of success that warm trip had, that I had to go and get more flying to make another stake. So I started to land around the tops of these mountains and the glaciers on there, and became very, very successful at it. There, well, as time went on, I got the first airplane I had was this Eagle Rock, which was a very fine airplane. It had known as a J5 engine in it, about 200 horsepower, and that was a fine airplane, except there was an open cockpit on there, and when you get 60 or 70 degrees below zero on there, it was kind of cold in there. Remember, I froze my eyeballs one time and I was laid up for about a week on there, but the cold didn't bother me too much on there. I was very thin at the time, and and had excellent circulation, and I really never troubled me except the time when I, well, I had to stick my head out of the cockpit and there and see where you're coming in the ice fog we used to have there. And I later purchased that in the December of 1932. I purchased a Fairchild from Pacific Alaska Airways, which had been surplus to their needs. It was known as a 51, a Fairchild 51. It was actually an FC-2 fuselage on there with a 330 right horsepower engine, Whirlwind engine on it, which was far more horsepower than the 200 horsepower, and was an excellent performer. In fact, it was one of the finest airplanes I ever flew in my life on there. Had a terrific performance. And I later, in fact, with that airplane, I had 21, as I recall, I had almost 20 forced landings in the time I had it, due to the fault of the old Whirlwind engines on there. They had a characteristic of the timing gear slipping and the engine quitting, and you came tumbling down. And as I recall, I had 5 forced landings one time in 3 days on with that airplane. And the last time I put near killed myself.